The group that went to talk to the elves reported that the only manifestation of Jimmy's work so far was that the entire town was thinner. So they were happy to leave things as they stood. That night, the wizards held the largest victory party of all time, when measured in terms of area. There were still only about 24 of them, but they had regained the ability to teleport, and having gone without it for the afternoon, they all felt like using it. The party started in Jimmy's former office, but soon some wizards wanted to see Philip's rec room, and others wanted to check out Skull Gullet Cave. Eventually, teleportation points were defined for several of the wizards' larger homes, and the event took on the feeling of a party held in a mansion, where one drifts from room to room. Only in this case, the rooms were spread all over Europe. The hardest part about throwing a party for time travelers was finding music everyone can enjoy. Everyone is invariably convinced that their artist, genre, format of choice is infinitely superior to all others. After making the obligatory rounds to see where everyone else lived and show them his empty storage facility, Martin settled into Philip's 80s-themed attic for the duration. But now it was getting late, and Philip was loudly explaining that Thomas Dolby had recorded more than one song. Martin decided he needed some air. Martin stepped through the open garage door and across the heavy wooden ramp that led to the hill behind Philip's shop. He found Gwen, sitting on the ground, fiddling with her wand and looking at the stars. Martin sat next to her. There were many things he missed about his own time, but he knew that if he ever went back, he would miss the medieval night sky. He knew it was the same sky, but it really wasn't. The lack of any light source brighter than a campfire meant that even here, on the outskirts of a medium-sized town, the sky was a spectacular vista of stars, far more than a city boy like Martin had ever realized were there. In his original time, a sky like this was a luxury he'd have to travel for hours out into the middle of nowhere to get. Here, on any clear night, he could just step outside and see the whole universe. After a period of time, Martin carefully calculated to seem nonchalant, he tore his gaze away from the sky and looked at Gwen. He opened his mouth to speak, but she beat him to it.
"I'm going to Atlantis. I'm leaving tomorrow,"
she said in a tone that left no room for questions. Martin wanted to say, "I'm sorry you got outed as a witch," but he didn't want to say outed or witch, for that matter. Female wizard sounded stupid. Lady Wizard was even worse. He tried to come up with a word that meant witch that didn't have any insulting or demeaning overtones. He couldn't. In fact, after some thought, he couldn't think of a word that meant female that men hadn't imbued with some belittling shade of meaning. Finally, after a much longer silence than he had intended, he simply said,
"I can understand why. Frankly, I'm not sure why you stuck around here to begin with. You're a wizard. Why hide that and pretend to be a tailor?"
Gwen said,
"I wasn't pretending to be a tailor. I am a tailor, Martin. It's a fair question, though. I came here because I'd read a lot of fairy tales when I was a girl, and I wanted to see what the reality was like. I decided to stay here because I was a lot better than I expected. I mean, the food, water, and sanitation aren't great. But we have ways around all of that. As a peasant, I'm powerless, but I'm just as powerless as a peasant man, so that's a kind of equality. It's a pretty good time to be an independent woman, as long as you can defend yourself and nobody gets it into their head that you're a witch. Of course, I don't know if that's the way it always was, or if that's just our influence. Atlantis isn't just far away, it's also long ago, if you see what I mean."
"I'm really sorry to see you go, though." She turned and graced Martin with the saddest smile he'd ever seen.
"I'm sorry to be going too, but most famous witch in medieval England isn't a title that comes with a lot of benefits."
Martin knew this was true. He kept his eyes on the stars and considered his next words carefully.
"I've known you a while, but it's like I just really met you today."
"Yes,"
Gwen said.
"It is.
And that's my own fault,"
Martin continued. Gwen laughed gently before saying,
"Yes, it is."
There was a long pause while Martin test ran several next sentences in his head before finally settling on the safest course of action. He turned his head to look at Gwen and said,
"Well, I guess this is goodbye then."
She looked back at him and said,
Yes.
They looked at each other for a moment. Then Martin asked,
Would you mind if I kissed you goodbye?
Gwen smiled and said,
No.
Martin was thrown high into the air, silver robe flapping in the wind. He landed on the roof of Philip's shop, where he slid limply, flopping off the side and falling into the valley where the side of the hill met the wall of the shop. Gwen, radiating with glowing power, cursed herself and shut off her macro. She stuffed her wand into her pocket before rushing to Martin's side. He was lying silently in the gutter, not moving. She tried to roll him over, but the fall had wedged him into the dirt crevasse. And now that she was close to him, she could see that he couldn't extricate himself because he was laughing too hard. He finally regained his composure enough to get up, but as soon as he made eye contact with Gwen, they both started laughing again. They didn't make another attempt at a kiss goodbye. They both knew that was a much more fitting end to their relationship. 29. Walter and Margarita Banks were living a nightmare. Their son Martin was acting crazy and running from the law. He was holed up in his childhood bedroom, but he kept re-emerging for nonsensical reasons, and the authorities were threatening to break down the door.
One moment, I'm coming!
Walter bellowed, more out of alarm than any anger he might have felt. He gave his wife what he hoped was a reassuring look and got one back from her in return as he started toward the door. Martin once again came out of his old bedroom and shouted,
No, Dad, stop!
He was wearing a shiny silver moo-moo of some sort and a matching Wee Willie Winky nightcap. He had mounted his old bust of Santo the Mexican Wrestler on a pole. It was clear to Walter that his boy was insane.
Martin, baby, what's going on?
Margarita asked.
What have you done?
It broke Walter's heart to hear her sound so distraught. Martin said,
Nothing! I haven't done anything!
He grabbed an armload of linens, all the while yelling,
I especially haven't done any of the things those men are going to tell you I did.
Martin awkwardly carried the bedding and the wrestler on a stick back into his bedroom, saying,
Thanks for everything! See you later! Dad, you can open the door now!
As he went. Walter knew what he had to do. There was no doubt in his mind that his son needed help. He opened the front door and said,
He's in his bedroom, this way.
Walter walked quickly to Martin's bedroom door and knocked firmly. The hall had instantly filled with men in dark suits and uniformed police officers.
Martin,
Walter said.
The police are here, and some men from...
Walter trailed off. One of the men in dark suits said,
The U.S. Treasury.
Walter and Margarita, who he could barely see at the back of the crowd of officers and federal agents, exchanged a look that only those who have been married for a long time can understand. Walter looked at the doorknob, then asked the agent closest to him,
Do you have a nail? If he locked the door, we'll need a nail.
The agent glared at him.
Martin!
Walter shouted in as calm a voice as he could muster.
We're coming in!
He tried the knob, and it turned easily. He opened the door, and the officers rushed in past him, but not before he saw that Martin was not in the room. He and Margarita watched as the officers flipped the bed, noting that the mattress was missing, which was odd. They looked in the closet, but Martin wasn't there. They opened the curtains, but there was a uniformed officer standing outside who insisted that he'd stood there the whole time and had not seen anybody in a silver robe dive out the window. The police seemed confused and angry as they searched the rest of the house, but the Treasury agents just seemed irritated. After a few minutes, the two agents who appeared to be in charge arrived. They introduced themselves as Miller and Murphy. Agent Murphy did all of the talking. He had a quiet, kind manner. He gently asked them questions, the answers to which were almost always no.
Did he tell you what he was up to? Do you know where your son went? Do you know how he went there?
After a couple of hours of this, the police announced that Martin was not there, and the Treasury agents announced that they knew that already. Agent Murphy left a business card. He made a point of saying that Martin had not hurt anybody, and that they didn't think he was dangerous, but if he did make contact, to please call the number on the card. Walter and Margarita Banks stood on their front lawn and watched the law enforcement officers drive away like they were watching relatives leave after a holiday dinner. The squad cars drove down the street, around the corner, and hopefully out of their lives. Margarita mentioned that it looked like someone had driven a car into the big tree at the end of the road. Walter reflected on the little things you notice when you're upset. They kept their arms around each other as they walked back into their home, closing the door behind them. They didn't have time to sit down before the doorbell rang. Margarita opened the door without bothering to ask who was there. When the door opened, Martin was standing on the front step. He had gotten a haircut and had shaved. He was wearing a nice dark gray suit, but no tie, instead leaving his dress shirt's collar open to the first button. Behind him, on the street, there was a taxi idling. Margarita gasped. Martin said,
"Mom, I'm so sorry."
She pulled him inside and hugged him to within an inch of his life. His parents wanted an explanation, but knew they weren't going to get one. Martin promised that he hadn't broken the law, and that it was all a big misunderstanding which he intended to straighten out. In the meantime, he wouldn't be around much, but they could always call him. He'd never be far from his phone.
"You know my old mattress and all that bedding I took?" Martin asked. "You're not going to be getting that back. Sorry. Do you still have that second box from Amazon I ordered?"
Walter shook his head.
"No, the cops took it. What was in it?"
"Nothing important. There's a company that makes modern computers that look exactly like an old Commodore 64. I'd bought one for a friend. I can just go buy another one before I go back."
"Go back where?"
Margarita asked. Martin answered,
"Home."
Martin walked out of his parents' house and got in the cab. He and the cabbie talked for a moment, and then the cab pulled away and turned left at the end of the block, disappearing from view. A man sat on his bicycle at the end of the street, next to the now damaged tree. He made a note of the exact time of departure, the license number of the cab, and direction of travel. He scribbled furiously into a tattered notebook with a small, greasy stub of a pencil. He let the saddle of his long-suffering bicycle support his weight. The worn-out toes of his off-brand sneakers rested on the sidewalk, more for balance than to carry any load. He was in his 60s, but looked terribly haggard. A ragged fringe of gray hair ringed his deeply sunburned bald spot. His skin was deeply creased and leathery. He had the gaunt frame and unhealthy demeanor of a man who had gotten far too much fresh air and exercise. The man finished his notation and closed the notebook. He slung his backpack off of his shoulders and opened it. It contained a little food, a few articles of clothing, mostly socks and underwear, and a great many cheap notebooks. No two were the same brand. Their labels were printed in a mix of English, Spanish, and Portuguese. All of them had a range of dates, stretching back to the 1980s. He placed his notebook in with the others, zipped the bag closed, and put it on his back where it belonged. He started riding down the sidewalk. He instantly became graceful once in motion. He clearly had plenty of practice riding his bike. A woman driving a huge SUV was trying to pull out of a parking lot. She stopped short of the sidewalk to let the man ride by. As he passed in front of her truck, the engine died. The man on the bicycle looked at her briefly, but kept moving. The woman cursed. She'd only had the vehicle for a few months. She really didn't want to have to deal with a tow truck and a mechanic tonight. She turned the key and was tremendously relieved when it started easily. She looked at the traffic, trying to find a place to jump in. She saw the man further down the street, still riding his bicycle.
"He's lucky," she thought. "I bet his bicycle never breaks down."
This audiobook is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of the next book in the series free.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Off to Be the Wizard by Scott Meyer. Copyright 2013 by Scott Meyer. Performed by Luke Daniels. Directed by Colleen Willits. Engineered by Jeff Colnut. Performance copyright 2013 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Spell or High Water by Scott Meyer. Performed by Luke Daniels. The following is intended to be a fun, comedic, sci-fi fantasy audiobook. Any similarity between the events described and how reality actually works is purely coincidental. 1. It was a normal evening at the inn called the Rotted Stump. Outside, the sun was setting and the town was getting quiet. Inside, candles were burning and the patrons were getting loud. Martin materialized across the street. He marveled at how quickly people get used to things. Here he was, a grown man in a shiny silver robe and pointed hat, coalescing out of thin air, brandishing a staff with a bust of a masked Mexican wrestler at its peak. And nobody, not the medieval peasants, nor he himself, found it odd. A passerby said a polite hello as he stepped around Martin. Martin returned the greeting and started across the street. 3 months ago, Martin was a 23-year-old data entry drone in Seattle who poked around in corporate computer systems in his spare time. 2 months ago, through a series of events that barely made sense to him, even though he'd lived through them, he found himself at this very inn in the year 1150, trying to pass himself off as a wizard. About a month ago, with quite a bit of help, he'd passed his training as a wizard, and now Martin was about to meet his very first trainee. It wasn't a huge surprise that the new trainee would turn up here at the Rotted Stump. When fleeing back in time, logic dictated that you use a geological landmark as a landing zone. And if you're going to England, you can't do much better than the cliffs of Dover. The road nearest to the cliffs led to this town, Ledchurch. And the inn was the first public establishment you found if you followed the road. It was more surprising that Martin had been called to go meet the new arrival. Martin was in his workshop when he got the call from Philip. Word had come that a stranger had arrived claiming to have magical powers. Someone would have to look into it. Philip was much closer, but part of his new job as chairman of the Wizards' Council was to delegate work to others. And in most cases, others meant Martin. Besides, the new wizard was at the exact same inn where Philip had found Martin just 2 months ago. Philip said he liked the symmetry of sending Martin as the welcoming committee. Martin jumped at the chance. Almost since the day he started training, he had looked forward to training someone himself. Martin's training had been a humiliating series of mind games, confusing revelations, and immature practical jokes. He found much of it profoundly unpleasant, and he wanted a trainee of his own. It would be his chance to take all of those miserable experiences and inflict them on someone else, instead of absorbing them himself. Martin paused before he entered the inn. He remembered the night 2 months ago when he'd arrived, hungry and more than a little scared. He had introduced himself to the patrons and proceeded to demonstrate his powers by transforming himself into a laughingstock. Eventually, Philip challenged him to a duel and blasted him into the woods, where he'd hit his head on a tree and passed out. He smiled at the thought of having the upper hand for once as he entered the inn. It was a warm, crowded room with exposed wooden beams. Candles and the sunset filtering through the windows were the only sources of light, which sounded more romantic than it looked. Indeed, not even romance itself would look romantic if it was being seen in the Rotted Stump. Martin scanned the room. It was a busy night. Strong men were drinking strong drinks and using strong language. He was looking for a youngish man, like himself, who seemed out of place, like he did, and was most likely in deep trouble, which he had been. As he peered into the murk, he heard a deep, booming voice shout, "Martin the Magnificent!" Martin tried not to cringe. One of his first acts upon arriving in medieval England was to give himself that nickname. And as with all self-bestowed nicknames, it had been an awful mistake that now haunted him. Pete, the owner of the rotted stump and whose absent right forearm gave the inn its name, got up from a raucous table in the corner and came to meet Martin, smiling broadly.
"Martin, good to see you, lad. Philip couldn't make it?"
Pete asked, patting Martin on the shoulder.
"Yeah, he's busy, so he sent me instead. Is there a problem, Pete?"
"No problem at all,"
Pete replied.
"Just a new wizard in town is all. He showed up dressed in strange clothes. I sent the boy to go fetch Philip right away. I needn't have hurried, though. He seems to be all right. He's already getting on much better than the last wizard that turned up."
Martin scowled.
"I was the last wizard that turned up."
Pete's smile didn't even flicker.
"Aye. He walked up to me and asked if I was in charge. I said I was, and he asks what we have to drink. I point to the beer barrel. He looks at it and says, 'That'll do.' He's been back there drinking and talking ever since."
"Has he offended anyone?" Martin asked.
"No, he fits right in. I think Gert's sweet on him. Come here, I'll introduce you."
As he crossed the room, Martin was able to pick the new wizard out of the group right away. It was his hair that set him apart. It was a fallacy that every man in medieval times had a flowing mane. There were a variety of hairstyles available to the stylish medieval male, but a perfectly trimmed, flat-top buzz cut was not one of them. Martin guessed that the new wizard was in his mid-50s. Beneath his iron-gray, military-grade haircut, he had dark, severe eyebrows and a perfectly trimmed mustache. He was wearing a flimsy white dress shirt and a thin black necktie. Instead of a wizard's robe, he wore a tan trench coat. Martin kicked himself for having not thought of that himself. It seemed as if a dim bar was the new wizard's natural habitat, even if it was a dim bar in the Middle Ages. Pete cleared his throat, and all conversation at the table stopped. The new wizard looked straight at Martin, making eye contact immediately. Gert sat next to the new wizard, towering over him like a slightly feminine oak tree. She had been smiling down at him, but when she looked at Martin, her smile turned effortlessly into a snarl. She liked Martin all right, but she already knew that she liked this new guy more, and she wanted Martin to know it as well. Pete gestured toward the new wizard with his hand and said,
"Martin, I'd like you to meet Roy. Roy, this is Martin."
Roy looked at Martin for a moment, then said,
"Oh yes, the apprentice. Your teacher couldn't make it?"
When Martin arrived in this time, he knew next to nothing. He hadn't known that there were other wizards with the same kinds of powers that he had, that the other wizards were time travelers from the late 20th and early 21st centuries, like he was, or that there was a training and orientation program in place for newly arrived wizards. Not knowing these things, he had made many mistakes. Clearly, the locals had already told this guy, Roy, all about the wizards and the training. They probably had told him about Martin's arrival, and from that, Roy could have figured out that the other wizards were probably time travelers like he was. Philip would have told Martin that there was a lesson in this about listening instead of talking, but Martin wouldn't have listened. Martin smiled at Roy and said,
"Welcome to Lead Church, Roy. You and I should talk."
Roy replied,
"We will, as soon as I finish my beer."
He lifted the earthenware mug to his lips. Judging by how he handled it, the mug was over half full. Martin leaned in slightly.
It's imperative that we speak. In private.
Roy said, I figured he meant in private, or else you'd have just started talking. That's why it has to wait until I'm done with my beer. I doubt that Pete wants me to take his mug. Do you, Pete?
No, Roy. My mug stays in my inn.
See, Martin? So unless you want to put my beer in your hat, we have to stay until I've finished it. Martin slowly, without breaking eye contact with Roy, removed his silver sequined wizard hat, muttered a few words under his breath, and pulled from the hat a mug identical to the ones Pete used for serving beer. He knew it was identical because he had made Pete's mugs in the same manner and given them to the innkeeper as a gift.
There, Martin said, smiling. This mug is mine, not Pete's, so we can take it wherever we like.
Roy said,
Good. Pete, please fill my young friend's mug with beer. It'll help him kill the time while I finish mine. Martin, you can take a seat, or because that is your mug, you're free to take it and wait outside if you like.
Martin sat at the table in silence, barely touching his warm beer. Roy didn't talk much either. Instead, the patrons of the Rotted Stump seemed eager to tell Roy everything they knew about the wizards who lived in the area, and the events of the previous month. Martin's arrival, the duel in which Martin was defeated by Philip, the mysterious deaths at Rickard's Bend. Martin's mood started to lighten as they described the battle at Camelot and the duel between Martin, Merlin, and Philip. He had to admit, he came off pretty well the way they told it. Going in alone, facing a more powerful adversary to buy his friends time, remaining brave in the face of what looked like certain death. Martin felt rather heroic, until Roy summed up what he had heard.
So Junior bit off more than he could chew, and his trainer had to come bail him out.
There was a tense silence. Martin decided to play it cool. He was the more experienced wizard. He had the upper hand here.
No, Roy, Martin said, shaking his head. There's more to it than that.
Roy snorted.
What did they leave out? Did you cry?
So much for feeling heroic,
Martin thought. Eventually, Roy finished his beer and started to settle up with Pete, who refused to take any payment, calling the drink a welcoming gift. He charged Martin full price for his beer, pointing out that Martin had been in town a while. The two wizards walked out into the chilly night air. Martin had decided not to have a public confrontation with the inexplicably popular newcomer, but now, away from Roy's fan club and with a beer in him, Martin felt freer to talk.
Look, Roy, he said. When I got word you were here, I dropped everything and came out from London to meet you.
Isn't it called Camelot now?
Roy asked.
For the time being. We're going to change that back. Anyway, I came all the way out here.
You teleported here. Don't forget, son, I found the same computer database you did. I know that our world is a simulation, and I know how to use the database to alter that simulation, or else I wouldn't be here in the first place. I know how to teleport. You probably do too, so don't pretend that the distance was some kind of big imposition.
Martin turned on Roy, poking him in the chest with his staff.
Look, Roy, I came here for your benefit. You can get into a ton of trouble around here if you don't let somebody show you the ropes. That's why I'm here, to show you the ropes, to help you stay out of trouble.
Roy brushed Martin's staff away from his chest with exaggerated care.
Okay, okay. Calm down, big guy. Don't get upset. I appreciate you coming to welcome me, but I'm a grown man. I don't need a kid to tell me what's what.
See, that just shows how little you know. There have been guys like us here for over a decade, and others who went further back in time than we did. There's a whole system built on top of that database to do things you haven't even thought of. Things like freezing the aging process. Just because a wizard looks a certain age doesn't mean they are that age. I could be 100 years old for all you know.
Martin stormed off down the street. Roy followed, thinking. Finally, Roy said,
"That's a good point, Martin. I hadn't thought about that."
"There are a lot of things you haven't thought about, Roy. That's why I'm here."
They walked in silence for a moment. They rounded a corner and were in the town's central square. The lead-covered church that gave the town its name was across the square, but, predictably, it didn't stand out particularly well at night. A few citizens milled about. One or two had torches, but most navigated by starlight. Roy and Martin continued walking across the square. Roy said,
"As you say, you could be older than me."
"Yes, I could."
"But back in the bar."
"In? You should get used to using the time-appropriate words. The rotted stump is an inn."
"Back at the inn, they said you only got here a couple of months ago."
"That's true."
"So you only had your aging stopped then. You're 25 years old, right?"
"23.
"Either way, you're a kid. This has been fun, but is there an adult available to train me?"
Martin stopped walking. Roy stopped after a step and turned around to smirk at him. Martin switched his staff from his right hand to his left, looking thoughtfully at the small plaster bust of Santo, the king of the luchadores, as he did so. He turned his attention back to Roy and calmly said the words,
"Akiri Grandan."
Martin glowed with eerie silver light that seemed to form a grid pattern on his skin. He divided along the grid lines into hundreds of small silver boxes, not dissimilar in shape to tiny coffins. The boxes blew apart, swirling around Roy, who was too stunned to move. The boxes multiplied and reformed into a new form which looked just like Martin, only 3 stories tall and made of glowing silver boxes. As the giant form spun into shape, its empty right hand swept Roy up and lifted him to the giant's eye level. Roy was held around the waist in the immense hand's uncomfortable grip. The other hand held a giant version of Martin's staff. Roy saw that the bust of Santo was also enlarged. Its eyes were glowing with the same sickly light. A voice, clearly Martin's, but louder and deeper, shouted,
"Silence!"
Then Martin's normal, much quieter voice addressed Roy.
"Look, the training isn't just to teach you what you can do. It also gives us a chance to learn what you're likely to do, and if we don't like what we learn, we will make sure that you don't do anything. That's not a threat. We won't hurt you, except in self-defense. We will strip you of your access to the file, that database of yours, and send you back where you came from in such a way that the authorities will be sure to find you. Do you want that, Roy? If so, just say the word. I'm your trainer. I can make that happen any time you like."
Roy squirmed, but the grip of the giant hand didn't loosen. They looked like a toddler playing with a Ken doll. Only the doll didn't feel like playing, and the toddler wanted to practice his throw. Martin pushed the head of the giant staff forward until it filled Roy's field of view.
"Do you want to go back, Roy?"
Roy gritted his teeth and said,
"No."
Martin smiled, but didn't move the staff. Not yet. In a much quieter voice, he said,
"Yeah, I bet you don't. Few of us come here because things are going well in our own time. Who's after you back there?"
Roy stared at the giant likeness of Martin's face until it was clear that he wouldn't be put down unless he answered.
"The CIA,
Roy said, then after a breath, he sighed and added,
"And the Department of Defense."
Giant Martin's face cracked a huge smile.
"Wow! I can't wait to hear that story."
Martin pulled his staff away, but kept Roy suspended 25 feet above the ground.
"Here's the deal,"
Martin said, at a volume carefully calculated so that only he and Roy would hear it.
"We wizards have to police ourselves, because there's nobody else who can police us. Part of how we do it is with the training. You can accept me as your trainer, and I'll show you how to fit in here in the past, how to use the powers we've created, and how to make new powers yourself. When I think you're ready, you'll face the trials. And once you pass them, you'll be on your own, free to do whatever you like, within reason. Don't accept the training and we'll assume you're up to no good, strip you of your powers and send you back to your time. Perhaps we'll send you to the courtyard in the center of the Pentagon. Not a lot of tourists get to see that, do they? What do you say, Roy? Do you accept the training?
Roy shrugged. Yeah, kid, I'm sorry. I accept the training.
Martin said, good, as he placed Roy back on the ground. As soon as Roy's weight was back on his own feet, Giant Martin silently exploded into thousands of silver boxes that flew outward, spun in space momentarily, then imploded back in on themselves, leaving normal-sized Martin in their place. Roy smoothed out his trench coat and looked around sheepishly.
Jeez, kid, you didn't have to get so sore about it. I was just messing with you.
Well, then you've just received your first lesson. Don't mess with me. Did you learn it, or will you need a review?
No, I got it.
Roy looked at the townsfolk in the square. There weren't many of them, but the few there were had stopped all activity and were watching the two wizards intently.
Did we have to do that in public?
Martin said, yes. In fact, I put it off until we got here because I knew there'd be people and plenty of room. I wanted witnesses for two reasons. One, it's good to remind the locals what we can do every now and then. Two, it was important that everybody know that I'm more powerful than you.
Important for the training?
Important to me, which as far as you're concerned is the same thing.
Martin reached out a hand to his trainee.
You'll be staying with me during your training. Take my hand. We'll teleport there.
Roy looked at Martin's hand as if he were holding a dead rat.
I'll just put my hand on your shoulder. That should work just as well.
Martin thrust his hand toward Roy.
Come on, don't be a baby. Take my hand.
Roy put his hand on Martin's shoulder and repeated,
I'll put my hand on your shoulder. That should work just as well.
Martin rolled his eyes and said,
I can see this relationship is going to take some effort.
Transporto Magazino!
Martin and Roy disappeared. 2. Jimmy walked at a brisk pace. He had a shocking amount of energy for a man in his 60s. That was one of the benefits of spending 30 years riding a bicycle. Another of the benefits was having plenty of time to think. Think and plan. He wasn't riding a bicycle now, and if things went the way he expected, he'd never ride one again. It was just as well, since he'd sold his. The day before, Jimmy had watched Martin lead a low-speed chase to his parents' home, then evade the police by fleeing back in time to medieval England, where he had caused Jimmy no small inconvenience. Once the police and two conspicuously out-of-place federal agents had left, Martin returned, a few hours later from his parents' perspective, several weeks later from their son's, the time traveler. After observing Martin leaving his parents' house by taxi, Jimmy had ridden straight to the homeless shelter he was using as a base of operations. The fluorescent lights flickered, and the TV went wonky as he walked through the shelter's rec room. He had found over the years that as long as he walked through such areas quickly, his disruptive magnetic field would be chalked up to a temporary brownout. He could get away with this for a week or so before someone would notice that the brownouts always happened when he walked by. For nearly 30 years, Jimmy had kept moving, both from room to room and from place to place. Jimmy retired to the private room he had sweet-talked the management into giving him. He went over his notes by flashlight. Batteries and incandescent light bulbs still worked for him. It was only integrated circuits that couldn't tolerate his presence, which included the ballasts in fluorescent lights. He'd had a good night's sleep, then got up bright and early and sold his bicycle to a panhandler for $30. Jimmy took his newfound fortune to the nearest thrift store, where he purchased the nicest suit they had in his size, a white shirt that only had stains on the back, and a tie that didn't have any cartoon characters on it. He also grabbed an ancient Samsonite briefcase. He paid cash. He had to let them keep what little change he was owed because the cash register mysteriously stopped working. He changed into his new outfit in the fitting room and dumped the contents of his backpack into his briefcase. He donated the backpack and his old clothes to the Goodwill, suspecting that they'd more likely burn them than sell them, then set out to face the new day. Jimmy had a plan, and that plan only called for him to look presentable for a few hours. After that, with any luck, he'd be under arrest. Jimmy walked down the pleasant suburban Seattle street. He'd spent so long staking this street out the day before, he knew it as if he'd grown up there. He hadn't, of course. Martin had. Jimmy stopped, checked his notes, made sure he had the right house, then strode up to Walter and Margarita Banks's door. He glanced at the button for the doorbell, then knocked. Three crisp, friendly-sounding knocks. He heard faint sounds coming from inside the well-maintained, split-level ranch house. After a moment, the door opened a crack. A pleasant, dark-haired woman, close to his own age, peered at him through the barely open door. The chain lock was still engaged. Jimmy wasn't surprised. These people had been through a lot the day before and were probably still pretty edgy. The woman said,
"I'm sorry it took so long. I barely heard you knock. We do have a doorbell."
Jimmy smiled.
"I'm sorry, I didn't see it there."
Margarita said,
"That's fine. So, what can I do for you?"
Jimmy's smile faded, the exact amount he had predetermined would convey a sense that he regretted having to bring up the subject he needed to discuss.
"Mrs. Banks, my name is James Sadler, but I'd like it if you call me Jimmy. I know your son Martin. I'd like to ask you a few questions, and I suspect you'd like to ask me a few of your own."
Margarita's smile froze, and all of the light drained from her eyes. She excused herself for a moment. Jimmy smiled kindly and told her he understood. She closed the door and called out for her husband. Jimmy heard bits of the conversation on the other side. He couldn't make out words, but the tone came through loud and clear. Mrs. Banks was upset. Mr. Banks was angry. Mrs. Banks calmed down a bit. Mr. Banks did not. Mrs. Banks tried to soothe Mr. Banks. Mr. Banks responded. Quiet conversation followed. Jimmy took a half step backward to appear less threatening. The doorknob jiggled slightly, then there was a moment of quiet, just long enough for both Jimmy and Mr. Banks to take a deep breath. The chain lock rattled and the door opened wide. Mr. Banks stood, filling the doorframe.
"I'm Walter Banks. What can I do for you, Mr. Sadler, was it?"
Jimmy bowed slightly. Just slightly enough that Mr. Banks wouldn't notice that he noticed it.
"Yes, Sadler. James Sadler. Martin calls me Jimmy."
Walter Banks made a sucking noise as he thought. Finally, he said,
"I don't think Martin's ever mentioned you." "No, Mr. Banks, I expect he hasn't. We haven't known each other for long. I'm very impressed with your son. He has a unique combination of intelligence and creativity. You should be proud."
"I am,"
Walter said flatly.
"You still haven't told me what you want, Mr. Sadler."
"Of course. Sorry, I'm a bit nervous,"
Jimmy lied.
"I want two things. I have one question I want to ask you and Mrs. Banks, but before that, I want to answer as many of your questions as I can."
Walter stared at Jimmy for a long time, then asked,
"So, you're involved in Martin's?"
Walter trailed off.
"Difficulties? Yes. At least I was once. I know a great deal about it, and while I won't be able to answer all of your questions directly, I should be able to leave you better informed than you are now."
After another staring match that Jimmy was careful to lose at the exact right moment, Walter invited Jimmy in. An hour later, the Banks' front door opened and Jimmy walked out. Walter and Margarita followed him out the door and saw him off. Walter grasped Jimmy's hand with both of his and shook it vigorously. Margarita gave Jimmy a hug. Jimmy thanked them for their help. and for the sandwich, which he assured them was delicious. Goodbyes were said, and the couple stood for a moment and watched him walk away before finally going back inside.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.